in the study occurred at a tense meeting between the FDA and the NIAID. Everyone knew the enormous implications of the audit findings. FDA's refusal to rubber-stamp Nevirapine's approval meant the collapse of the Bush administration's most visible foreign policy program. Dr. Fauci had persuaded the president to make the abolishment of African AIDS his moonshot project, his career legacy, and Nevirapine was the foundation stone of that project. The severe embarrassment to the president and to the NIH would also engulf Uganda's Makerere University, Beringer, the investigators, and their employers, Johns Hopkins University and Family Health International, FHI, the organization responsible for monitoring the trial. It would antagonize the South African government, whose drug regulatory agency, the Medicines Control Council, MCC, permitted the distribution of Nevirapine under duress based solely on the fraudulent results of the Uganda study published in Lancet in 1999. Curiously, Dr. Fauci did not attend the meeting to take responsibility for his institute's leading role in the catastrophe. He dispatched his underlings to absorb the spanking. It was a great embarrassment to the Bush administration, because that was their big initiative, recalls Farber. In any other circumstances, Nevirapine would have been DOA in FDA's licensing process. But Nevirapine was Tony Fauci's baby. He had staked his credibility with the president on the success of this trial. Like AZT, Nevirapine was therefore too big to fail. Such desperate circumstances summoned Teflon Tony to perform his greatest magic act, resurrect the dead. Tony Fauci knew that Nevirapine had fundamental safety and efficacy deficits that went way beyond record-keeping, says Farber. Those problems were existential. The drug didn't work, and it killed both mothers and children. According to Farber, two inspections had now declared HIV-NET-012 to be a complete mess, Beringer's own and Westat's, which had been performed in conjunction with NIAID. But the ways in which the various players were tethered together made it impossible for NIAID to allow the study to die without embarrassing Dr. Fauci in his relationship with President Bush, and without implicating NIAID in the Uganda scandal. NIAID sprang into cover-up mode. Dr. Fauci, by now adept at manipulating both elected officials and a credulous press, had his PR team begin the resurrection project by refashioning the Uganda charnel house scandal as a simple misunderstanding based on minor clerical errors. Blithely ignoring FDA's dire safety and efficacy signals and Beringer's demeaning withdrawal, NIAID issued a press release characterizing its Ugandan atrocities as mere record-keeping glitches. NIAID's statement claimed that while certain aspects of the collection of the primary data may not conform to FDA regulatory requirements, no evidence has been found that the conclusions of HIV-NET-012 are invalid or that any trial participants were placed at an increased risk of harm. To the contrary, the communique assured the public NIAID's trial had proven Nevirapine both safe and effective. Summoning his extensive web of loyal dependencies, Dr. Fauci lined up a host of organizations, including the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation, Johns Hopkins, Beringer Ingelheim, and others, to issue statements and press releases supporting NIAID's official narrative. NIAID portrayed the devastating Beringer withdrawal as merely a temporary setback, which Dr. Fauci, in a perverse but inspired twist of Orwellian newspeak, recast as an admirable demonstration of corporate responsibility. In July 2002, DAIDS announced that it would reassess the Uganda Nevirapine study with its own in-house remonitoring protocol, a fancy construction for whitewash, managed by Fauci's top aides henchman, DAIDS Director Edmund Tremont. However, in an uncharacteristic faux pas, Tremont included his hand-picked DAIDS in-house review team, which included the agency's medical officer, Dr. Betsy Smith, who was not down for the cover-up. During her document inspection, Dr. Smith took notice of the poor quality and the incompleteness of the safety data. Shoddy record-keeping at the site revealed that the study did not comply with good clinical practice, GCP, guidelines. GCP is a requirement for all NIH-funded clinical research, and any studies conducted for the purpose of supporting the safety and effectiveness of investigational drugs. Dr. Smith's draft safety report raised all kinds of noisome alarms. She noted that medical records such as clinical notes, which are source documents needed to validate study data, were missing, incomplete, and often unsigned or undated. This made it difficult to validate the occurrence of adverse events. Poor quality clinical records were below expected standards of clinical research, especially for a study of such great importance. Smith and regulatory branch chief Mary Ann Luzar also uncovered serious health injuries in the chaotic Uganda safety records. Babies in the AZT arm were showing consistently elevated liver enzymes, injuries consistent with Nevirapine's long history of provoking lethal liver failure. She found that the Uganda team had neglected to report numerous infant deaths and routinely failed to track patients who had abnormal lab values, clinical signs, and symptoms to determine how these problems resolved. Further complicating that problem, the study team did not interpret laboratory results using the standard toxicity grading scales that the protocol required, but had spitballed their assessment using less stringent grading scales and creating a team-defined reporting algorithm for study with the goal to report fewer AEs and SAEs, adverse and serious adverse events. This was the delicate lingua franca that bureaucrats employ to accuse one another of fraud. Dr. Jackson had not trained his study staff on how to report SAEs, and his team neither tracked nor reported AEs, including serious ones. Instead of treating these grave deficiencies with appropriate concern, FHI's research monitors, who had been visiting the site for years, made light of the problems. Their on-the-ground solution to the Nevirapine toxicity problem in Africa was to simply not monitor for safety, says Farber. Dr. Smith realized the monumental implications of her findings, which jeopardized the mission-critical project to license Nevirapine to prevent maternal-to-child transmission of HIV. Dr. Smith therefore trod delicately. She concluded her report by stating, "Safety reporting did not follow DAIDS reporting requirements during the conduct of HIV NET012. Safety conclusions from this trial should be very conservative." Dr. Fauci had sold his Nevirapine enterprise as a heroic moment for American greatness, recalls Celia Farber. Dr. Fauci said he was going to save African pregnant women and their babies. It turns out that this is an extremely dangerous drug with no demonstrated ability to save a single life. This isn't rocket science. Dr. Fauci knew all about the safety problems, but for Fauci and his cult of HIV drug worship, no drug is ever unsafe. Farber researched the episode extensively for her 2006 article in Harper's Magazine, "Out of Control, AIDS and the Corruption of Medical Science." Dr. Smith's conclusions in her safety report if allowed to stand, would kill Navarapin's chances of winning FDA approval for preventing maternal-to-child transmission. Despite all these setbacks, NIAID's powerful apparatchik didn't seem to fret that FDA was now unlikely to grant Navarapin its official safety imprimatur. Dr. Fauci employed the same ploy that Bob Gallo used when he recruited Margaret Heckler as his useful idiot to convince the world that NIH's intrepid scientists had identified the viral culprit behind AIDS. By now, Dr. Fauci was acting on a much larger stage. On January 29, 2003, the new president took the podium at his State of the Union speech and announced Dr. Fauci's new program to the world, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, PEPFAR. On the continent of Africa, nearly 30 million people have the AIDS virus, yet across that continent, only 50,000 AIDS victims, only 50,000, are receiving the medicine they need. I asked the Congress to commit $15 billion over the next 5 years, including nearly $10 billion in new money, to turn the tide against AIDS in the most afflicted nations of Africa and the Caribbean. His power to deliver a $15 billion health program and to summon unprecedented accolades from a sitting president gave Dr. Fauci unchallengeable power over the entire U.S. health bureaucracy unmatched in American history. He now enjoyed consolidated power over HHS and all its subsidiaries. After Bush's State of the Union, all of HHS fell in line behind Dr. Fauci's project to rewrite history, recalls Farber. The political stakes were very high. To save the reputation of his boss and employer, and by extension everyone else implicated in this scandal, Ed Tremont rose to the task. Tremont went to work by eliminating inconvenient facts recorded by Betsy Smith and top regulatory compliance officer in the NIH's AIDS division, Mary Ann Luzar, by reorganizing the disqualified Uganda data. When DAIDS released Tremont's edited version of the remonitoring report on March 30, 2003, Dr. Smith's safety review had vanished. In its place was a safety section Tremont later admitted having ghostwritten. Tremont had begun with a straightforward revision of the Safety Review Committee's conclusion, altering it from unfavorable to favorable. Tremont's purged draft boldly concluded, "Single-dose Navarapin is a safe and effective drug for preventing mother-to-infant transmission of HIV. This has been proven by multiple studies, including the HIV-NET-012 study conducted in Uganda." Tremont began massaging data sets to conform the rest of the report to this adjusted outcome. Tremont dismissed concerns raised by Luzar about pediatric liver problems and forged in his own bleached conclusions that the drug was safe. In Dr. Fishbein's words, Tremont simply rewrote the safety section, minimizing concerns about the toxicities, deaths, and record-keeping problems that had been highlighted by his medical safety expert. Tremont's editing skills produced a document that laid the foundation in December 2002 for FDA's approval of the lethal concoction for global use on pregnant women. The Presidential Seal of Approval. Then Teflon Tony played his trump card. Dr. Fauci's coup de grace was a White House announcement that Bush would anoint the scandal-ridden Navarapin project with a personal site visit. The presidential junket would serve as a kind of public purification ritual to purge away the scandal and anoint Navarapin with legitimacy. The special bravado that allowed Dr. Fauci to summon a president to a distant continent and to make Dr. Fauci's personal agenda the centerpiece of White House foreign policy was a demonstration of power that could only provoke the entire awestruck public health bureaucracy to stand at attention and salute. What FDA bureaucrat would now have the courage to taint this prestigious HHS triumph with awkward questions about safety and efficacy? Dr. Fauci wanted the HIV-NET site reopened for President Bush's visit, Dr. Fishbein told me. That visit was such an embarrassment to all of us who knew the truth, but everyone fell into line. The USAID's media even began to refer to Museveni suddenly as a benevolent dictator. Farber remarks, that presidential junket was so transparently phony, a shameless exercise in colonial public relations and lies. On July 11, 2003, President Bush toured the clinical trial site in Kampala, which DAIDS had hurriedly reopened and populated with temporary health workers for the occasion. Dr. Fishbein explained to me, NIAID officials rushed to reopen the site despite my concerns that it wasn't ready. But Tremont overruled me. He wanted the restriction lifted ASAP because, in his words, the site is now the best in Africa run by black Africans, and President Bush was scheduled to be there in 4 days. Said Farber, NIAID officials rushed to reopen the site to paper over the disgrace and to impress and deceive the president. She added, it was really straight up, Potemkin's Village, a vast PR campaign with nothing behind the Hollywood facade except death. Dead babies, dead mothers, we will never know their names. Almost all of HHS was now behind Dr. Fauci's project to rewrite history. In July 2002, DAIDS announced that it would reassess the Uganda Nevirapine study. Presenting awards to one another is a knee-jerk strategy by which vaccine experts paper over malfunctions and atrocities. It is therefore not surprising that, to advance the cover-up and absolve the Uganda research team, Tremont recommended that Dr. Fauci get his putative NIH boss, Elias Zerhuni, to present Dr. Jackson and his Uganda project researchers who had supervised the African debacle with an NIH award. This strategy would co-opt the NIH director into the cover-up and fortify institutional resistance to a full-blown investigation. Tremont assigned the task to his flunky, DAIDS's deputy director John Kagan, but in a rare display of independent good judgment, Kagan protested that giving awards to the clowns who had killed all those Africans, probably with criminal negligence, was a bridge too far. We cannot lose sight of the fact that they screwed up big time, and you bailed their asses out, he advised Tremont by email. I'm all for forgiveness, etc. I'm not for punishing them, but it would be over the top to me to be proclaiming them as heroes. Something to think about before pushing this award thing. But the conspirators had a problem. NIH medical officers Betsy Smith and Mary Ann Luzar were not willing participants to the cover-up. To tie up the last loose ends, Kagan ordered NIAID's ethics officer, Dr. Jonathan Fishbein, to reprimand Luzar for insubordination. The admonishment would bring the agency's ethics division into the cover-up and create an insurance policy if Luzar blabbed to anyone about all those African kids with collapsed livers. An official reprimand from a supposedly independent ethics officer would allow NIAID to discredit Luzar as a disgruntled employee. But Dr. Fishbein's investigation convinced him that the whistleblower Luzar was a hero. He told Tremont that he could find no justification for Luzar's reprimand and advised him against issuing the official rebuke. They were out to get her because she refused to compromise her integrity, Dr. Fishbein told me. Faced with Dr. Fishbein's resistance, Tremont backed down. In Dr. Fishbein, Dr. Fauci's team had run up against a public health official naive enough or conscientious enough to say no. Meanwhile, Dr. Fishbein's investigation of Luzar gave him additional reasons to mistrust Kagan's judgment. Female employees reported to Dr. Fishbein that Kagan was sexually harassing them. Tremont may have felt that Dr. Fishbein was purposefully goading him when, instead of rebuking Luzar, Dr. Fishbein filed a sexual harassment complaint against Tremont's sidekick and enforcer. Kagan was Fauci's bagman, AP reporter John Solomon told me. He was a career Army guy from Fort Detrick or Walter Reed. Dr. Fishbein concurred in this assessment. He was a just-following-orders kind of guy, brought in to put a layer of insulation between Fauci and all the institutionalized mismanagement in his HIV clinical trials. Dr. Fishbein adds that the corruption that had begun with AZT then metastasized throughout the entire program. Dr. Fishbein adds, the sexual harassment issues aside, Kagan was a miserable manager. Boehringer Ingelheim never resubmitted its application to the FDA for preventing maternal-to-child transmission of HIV. Nevertheless, WHO, which, as we shall soon see, was by then under the control of Bill Gates and Anthony Fauci, began shipping this lethal concoction to developing nations globally to use on their pregnant women. It's a mystery why Nevirapine was ever developed, launched, or marketed to the developing world the way it was, says journalist Celia Farber, since it was rejected by every Western drug safety agency, every single time. Why was it then repurposed and shipped to non-Westerners? The double standard is quite stark. We need to start calling it what it is. Says Dr. Fishbein, the tragic irony here is that the Kampala-Nevirapine research was performed to a level of standards that would be insufficient for supporting the drug's approval for use in the United States. But Fauci fervently defended the study as adequate to justify giving Nevirapine to black Africans. Frankly, it strikes me as racist. Reverend Jesse Jackson echoed Fishbein's sentiment. This was not a thoughtful and reasonable decision, but a crime against humanity. Research standards and drug quality that are unacceptable in the U.S. and other Western countries must never be pushed onto Africa. Profits to die for. The pharmaceutical and the medical cartel's historical preference was to test dangerous drugs and medical procedures on people of color. But by the late 1990s, black Americans were increasingly suspicious of medical authorities. President Clinton's belated 1996 official apology to the victims of the Tuskegee syphilis experiments, 1935 through 1973, had reminded blacks of other historic atrocities, including the barbaric gynecological experiments on black women by Dr. J. Marion Sims, father of modern gynecology. In 1992, a Los Angeles Times expose revealed that the CDC had been conducting unlicensed experiments with the deadly flu vaccine on black children in Haiti and Cameroon, and on 1,500 black children in South Central Los Angeles beginning in 1986. Blacks were therefore understandably reluctant to sign up for clinical trials. Despite vigorous efforts by pharmaceutical companies and regulators to recruit blacks, fewer than 4% of clinical trial enrollees in America were black. Nevertheless, Dr. Fauci seemed to have a genius for finding blacks, both American and African, to participate in his HIV chemotherapy drug experiments. In 2003, an HIV-positive African-American mother in Memphis, Tennessee, died during one of Dr. Fauci's Nevirapine drug trials. In April of that year, Joyce Ann Hafford, 4 months pregnant, and already the mother of a gifted 13-year-old, was shocked to learn she had tested positive following a routine HIV test recommended by her pediatrician. Believing her diagnosis to be a death sentence, Hafford enrolled in DAIDS's clinical trial at the University of Tennessee in hopes of saving her soon-to-be-born son from getting AIDS. Dr. Fauci's local PI,